Welcome to The Plants We Eat, an investigation of the history, biology, and culture of the plants that we use for food. I'm Jeff Gilman, director of the UNC Charlotte Botanical Gardens and plant history enthusiast.
And I'm Cindy Proctor, instructor at CPCC Charlotte, North Carolina, and an urban landscape consultant.
And today we're going to talk about the most popular, the fruit with the greatest value in production in the entire world, and that is the famous, the awesome, the amazing grape. That's right. We're talking about the grape today.
Great. I can't wait.
Well, you know, the thing about grapes are that we've used them for centuries, millennia, and mostly, of course, we use them not because they're grapes, but because they make alcohol. I looked at a lot of different sources to find out how grapes were used, and it's really all over the board. I actually didn't find a lot of consistency. But this is pretty typical. About 50% of grape production is used for wine, 46% is used for fresh fruit, and 4% is used for dried fruit, and that's from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations in 2014. Most of the places that you look at are going to say that over 50% of the production of grapes is for wine, is for alcohol. It's been used, grapes have been used for alcohol since at least 6500 BC, and probably it's been used for a lot more than that. Grapes have been used for food, for at least tens of thousands of years.
Well, that makes sense because there's quite a bit of wineries in the U.S. that I've even noticed have popped up, you know, a good bit over the past 10 years even. And I looked that up. There's almost 8,000 wineries in the U.S.
8,000?
Yes, 8,000.
That's just incredible. So that's the primary use of grapes,
and
right there.
And 350 million gallons of wine.
Oh, my goodness.
Are produced.
Oh, my goodness.
That's really only from January to July.
It's, you know, it's fascinating just how much people want to intoxicate themselves.
That's right. And, you know, California, of course, is the state that produces the most grapes, and they produce about 90% of our U.S. wine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, none of that is surprising. And I can't wait to hear about the history because there's a long-standing history with grapes. And, you know, that's not my favorite thing, but I'm anxious.
Well, there's a lot of neat things going on with grapes. And let me start by saying that I'm not going to deal with seeded grapes so much.
Okay.
Seeded grapes are mostly used for wine. Of course, you have things like Pinot Gris, you've got Cabernet, you've got Chardonnay. These are all different varieties.
All wonderful names.
All wonderful names. They really are wonderful names. And they're all for what we call cultivars or particular types of wine, and we don't worry when we're making wine whether there's seeds, whether there aren't seeds. It just doesn't make much of a difference. But when you're eating grapes for a food, either as dried or as fresh fruit, you're really dealing with
a seeded grape or a not a seed grape.
You're dealing with a seedless grape.
A seedless grape, okay.
Right. When you're doing raisins and you're doing fresh fruit, normally you're using a seedless grape. And those seedless grapes actually all come from one place. And before I get into that, I should mention there are about 80 species of grapes in the world.
You would think there would be more.
I know. You would think there would be more.
Yeah, you'd think there would be more. But yeah, I saw that too. There's not very many species.
There aren't a lot, but they do hybridize, so you can actually cross them. In Europe and in Asia, the most common type of grape is called the common grape. What a surprise. It's called the common grape. Over here in the United States, we have a number of different types of grapes, but the two that we see most commonly are the muscadine and the fox grape.
Okay.
The muscadine, very common in the South. Up north, we have the fox grape, and the most famous type of fox grape is the Concord grape. But let's go back to our seedless grapes, because seedless grapes are mostly come from the common grape. That's where most of our seedless grapes come from. And our seedless grapes actually come from one single variety of grape that just appeared one day, again, thousands of years ago. And that is, and some of you kind of heard this, that is the Thompson seedless grape.
Oh, yeah.
You've heard of the Thompson seedless?
Yeah, of course.
Something like 90% of our raisin production is with Thompson mm-hmm. Seedless.
It's a very vigorous grape.
It's a very vigorous mm-hmm. grape. It's if you remember the green seedless grapes mm-hmm. that used to be so common and still are very common, those are Thompson Seedless grapes. And you know, those have been around for a long, long time. Now, since it's been around for thousands of years, as you might presume, they were not originally called Thompson's. Thompson's is just a synonym that appeared around 1875, and it comes from this guy, William Thompson, who actually got this other grape and basically tied his name to it. The original name, or the name that's usually used for Thompson's, if you go to other countries, is Sultana grapes.
Okay.
So Sultana is that cultivar from which all seedless grapes come. Okay. Now, with the Sultana grape, again, this is kind of the original seedless grape. With the Sultana grape, you can make crosses to make other seedless grapes. And usually what you do is you take the pollen from the Sultana grape and you put it onto the female part of a seeded grape. And then some of your progeny, some of your offspring will be seeded and some will be seedless.
So is seedless a dominant trait? You know?
It's not a dominant trait. Okay. They usually come out from what I've read about one to one.
Right. Okay.
Seedless versus seeded.
That just
seeded.
Would surprise me. That's
yeah.
why.
Yeah.
I think of seedless and trait. Thornless and you know, yeah, not a dominant
yeah.
trait.
Okay. I don't believe it is, but I don't know the genetics on it either, so I'm not gonna claim that I do.
Okay.
So we've got this seedless grape, and we can cross it with a seeded grape, and we'll get then some seedless and some seeded grapes, and that's how we're getting, for example, our red grapes and our black grapes, which are seedless now by doing these crosses. There are actually a couple of common grapes that we see today, which are just coming out, which are really interesting, and which have this Thompson background. Are you familiar with the cotton candy grape?
I'm not. I've heard of it, but I'm not as familiar with it.
It's a really neat grape. It's got about 12% more sugar than our typical grapes that you see on the table. And the thing about it is apparently it tastes, and I have not tried it yet, apparently it tastes just like cotton candy. So
is it for wine?
It's not for wine.
Okay, so it's a table grape?
It's a table grape. Okay. It's a seedless table grape.
So if I is that why one tastes sweeter than the other when I'm sampling them at the grocery store?
Because they have higher sugar content.
Yeah, maybe it's a cotton candy one.
It's just, right, exactly. Okay. The cotton candy grape, another interesting thing about it is that it is a cross between the fox grape and the common grape. So it's actually a cross between the European grapes and the grapes that you find naturally native to the United States.
That's
and by the way, it's called fox grape. Common grape has its name for, you know, it's obvious because everybody knows the common grape. The fox grape has the name fox grape because when the Europeans came over here, they saw this grape and they thought that it smelled like fox dens. So that's why they named it the fox grape. So the cotton candy grape not only tastes like cotton candy because of its incredibly high sugar content, but because it gets some of that funky flavor from the fox grape, and just a little bit of that funky flavor kind of gives that cotton candy.
I need to pause for a minute. So yeah. Somebody smelled a grape that emulated a fox den, and they thought to taste it anyway.
You know, you and I are familiar with muscadines.
Yes.
And let me tell you something. Muscadine does not have a particularly pleasant odor
either.
Fair enough. And I have to tell you, the first time I tasted muscadine, I wasn't really fond of it, but that's a grape that really grows on you. After you have two or three.
Well, its skin is really hard. You know, it's tougher than what we're used to in terms of table grapes. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Another interesting grape that you'll see out there now is the Moondrop grape. And the Moondrop grape also has kind of a neat flavor. And it has straight common grape parentage. It doesn't have any of that fox grape or any other parentage. It's straight common grape. So, all kinds of interesting grapes out there. So this seedless condition hasn't appeared just once. It's actually appeared a few times. Almost all of our current seedless grapes do come from Sultana or Thompson, mm-hmm. from breeding with that. But actually, there are a few others that have been around for a while that are at least interesting. One of those is the black Manuka. And if you've ever seen I think they call them dark raisins or black raisins. Those are actually black manukas, and those are going to be actually sweeter than the Thompsons. And the other one that you'll sometimes see are currants. And believe it or not, these currants are actually a type of grape, just a smaller grape. They're a type of common grape. So kind of neat that we've developed this seedless over the years.
You know, you hear the word currant used in old fashioned, you know, type sense, and so I never equated that with the grape before.
But it is. So currant is the dried, again, a type of dried grape. So really cool. And by the way, currants, they actually do have a cultivar name if you're in the grape world, and that's black Corinth. And they were actually originated in Greece,
okay.
And there are records of them back to right around the time of Christ. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I want to tell you a little bit about the amazing history of grape in Europe, particularly wine grapes, because some really amazing things happened in Europe over the years, especially in the 1800s. I'm going to start off by telling you about the pests of grapes here in the United States, and there are a few. A few of them get really bad, but there are a few.
Not surprising.
It's not.
Our climate is really very similar and different at the same time than Europe. So, yeah, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
That's okay. So one of the biggest pests over here of the grape is called the phylloxera. And it's a type of, it's similar to the aphid.
If
you don't know your insects very well, it's basically an aphid. And the phylloxera can attack two parts of the grape. It can attack the leaf, and it can attack the root.
That's unusual.
It is unusual, yeah. But it's a different type of insect, again, related to an aphid. On the leaves, it looks really bad, creates a gall, which is just a little swelling on the leaf. It's bad, but it doesn't usually really hurt the plant too much.
It's meaner. It sounds meaner than an aphid. You know,
it is meaner.
Aphids
than
don't usually produce galls.
It is
know?
Meaner than
okay.
an aphid.
Okay.
And then it's nastier. Well, you know, it hits the leaves just like an aphid, except
right.
it creates this gall, this structure. That's bad, but usually the plant can get out of it. When it hits the roots, it's a bigger deal.
Okay.
Because when it hits the roots, you know, that's what's bringing water and nutrients to the plant.
Sure.
It can be a really big deal if it nails the roots.
So is that insect actually going to the root level?
It's going to the
okay.
root level.
That's
okay.
it. Okay.
So American grapes get this pest, but usually, even at the root level, it causes issues, but it's not major. The plant won't usually die. Well, here's the thing. This phylloxera found its way to Europe, which is not surprising. We all like to experiment with different types of plants. So the Europeans brought grapes from the United States over to Europe to experiment with these grapes to make different wines,
and
to try out different things.
And the insect and disease followed. Yeah.
The insect and
disease. They're good travelers just like us. So yeah.
Exactly. So the phylloxera goes over there and it starts, you know, this phylloxera normally would attack the muscadine, the fox grape. Well, over in Europe, all of a sudden it started attacking the common grape. And when it hit the common grape, well, the common grape had never seen it before. And because it had never seen it before, it had absolutely no defenses. When the phylloxera hit the roots of the common grape, it would wipe out whole, you know, grape orchards.
How devastating.
It was. In fact, this was called, there was a name for this. It was called the Great Wine Blight.
Okay.
Because it took out so many vineyards. It was introduced in the 1850s, and by 1889, about two-thirds of European vineyards had been destroyed. In France alone, wine production was reduced by well over 50%. So this, as you can imagine, is a big deal because, you know, from everything that I hear, Europeans really like their alcohol.
You said that with a serious face at first.
Well, yeah, because people in the United States don't like their alcohol, right? In fact, pretty much every culture that I've ever been associated with or known some
that's right.
like their alcohol. All right, so here's this. So you know this about me, and the people listening may not, but I'm an entomologist. I spend a lot of time in entomology, and there are a few, in entomology, there are a few, well, all right, not a few, there's one superhero. I'm serious. This guy's amazing. Okay. C.V. Riley.
Oh.
Have you heard of C.V. Riley?
I thought you were going to say Jay Gilman.
No. Me. No.
Me. That's right. Yes, I have, actually.
Good.
Yes.
Fantastic. Yes. So C.V. Riley is known for a lot of different things. The thing that I was most familiar with prior to this research, I was most familiar with him bringing the Dahlia beetle to the United States to help control cottony cushion scale in oranges. We nearly lost our orange crop in the 1800s because there was this problem called cottony cushion scale. And C.V. Riley brought the Dahlia beetle from Australia to attack cottony cushion scale. And really, that's why we have citrus production in the United States today. He's famous for this, but he's famous for a lot more than this. And one of the things he's famous for is figuring out a way to control phylloxera in grapes. And what he did was to figure out that you could graft common grape onto rootstocks of United States grapes.
Oh, see. That just opened up the doors for eradicating the blight and overcoming, you know, weather issues, just all kinds of ramifications in a good way.
Exactly. So not only did it control the insect, it also expanded the range of the grape. One of the big concerns they had was that by using this United States rootstock, you'd somehow change the grapes. But after they did a lot of experimenting and ultimately they found that there was no significant change in the grapes. The United States rootstocks pretty much just controlled the phylloxera and really didn't affect the flavor of the grape. So that was a huge deal. In fact, most of the rootstocks that we use today, or at least many of the rootstocks we use today, are actually pre-1930 selections. So, you know, all these rootstocks that we have actually come from kind of the C.V. Riley era and a little bit later than that, obviously. So something that's interesting that happened during this whole thing is that while these rootstocks were being shipped across to be tested, another disease came in.
Of course.
Of course, right, because you're shipping all these rootstocks over.
Yeah.
Well, another disease came in, and that was downy mildew.
Oh.
And it's similar to, many of you are probably familiar with something called powdery mildew, with this white stuff that gets on a lot of different plants, especially roses. Well, this downy mildew is roughly similar to that. It would get on the plants, and it would cause major problems. And this led to another tremendous discovery, actually, of one of the most important fungicides that we even use still today. And that is Bordeaux mix. And you see, what happened is that in Bordeaux, in the Bordeaux region of France, there was this problem that they were constantly having, and that was people. People walking down the roads would constantly pick grapes off of the grapevines that were close to the road. So because they'd pick these grapes off these grapevines, the growers started spraying junk on the grapes to keep people off. And the junk they would use is a mixture of copper sulfate, which is this blue-green yuck, mixed with hydrated lime, and it was just really yucky looking. And it tasted foul. So nobody wanted to eat the grapes off the side of the road. You could wash it off, but it would take some serious washing.
So they must have been really impacting their yield to go to this trouble. And I'm visualizing people going down the country road just feasting, you know.
That's what they did.
And I guess what they were doing.
Well, remember, this is a time when they're actually just all over Europe. There wasn't – food production wasn't at a high point.
Yes.
So this was a big deal. And this could be, for some people, a major source of calories.
Absolutely.
So they sprayed this hydrated lime and copper sulfate on the grapes. And then what happened is that they had this tremendous outbreak of downy mildew. And the downy mildew just nailed the Bordeaux region. There was essentially 100% reduction in grape production. It was that bad, except for the grapes along the sides of the road where the Bordeaux mix, this mixture of copper sulfate and hydrated lime, where that was sprayed, your grapes were healthy. And so this guy named Marie-Alexis Millardet, he was a botanist, and he noticed this, and that was obviously a very huge deal, and we even use Bordeaux mixture today, and that's the grapes, the common grape, the wine we drink today, was saved by C.V. Riley, who figured out how to graft the common grape onto other grapes, and by Maria Alexis Milladay, who figured out how to spray this Bordeaux mixture onto grapes to protect them from fungi. So we owe, you know, in terms of pest control, we owe a huge debt, not only to these people, but to the grape for having these problems in the first place.
That's right. I love this, actually. I know that surprised you. I'm kind of surprised myself.
I think this stuff is, I think, absolutely fascinating.
Well, it's wonderful to learn the contributions that people have made to what we enjoy today. You know?
Absolutely. So the grape, of course, is one of the most interesting fruits out there. It's a berry, you know. It's a true berry. You know, we've talked previously in our last episode about the strawberry, which has the word berry in it. It's not even a straw. It's not even a berry in any way. But the grape actually is a true berry. And it's a really interesting plant to grow.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. But honestly, when I think of grapes, I don't think of wine. I think of snacks and kids' lunches and, you know, what we call as table grapes, mm-hmm. you know, and I think they're overlooked a good bit, but they are a seedless grape as well. Yeah. But whether you want to grow grapes for eating as a table grape or for wine, you can grow them in your backyard. And it's fairly simple once you get started. There's some first 3 years are really important to creating the main structure of the grape and the framework, and of course your trellising. Mm-hmm. But
Now, what's a trellis? How does that work?
Well, so a trellis could, you know, we use trellises in the past for our roses and things like that. But when you're talking about for grapes, it is a strong structure. The best success is going to be like a fence mm-hmm. without the grid. And have like a T formation of your fence where your grapevines are growing in between and they have lateral wiring going through. And it's good to have some sort of metal, you know, metal posts that are planted maybe 6 to 10 feet apart and plant your grapevine in between those metal posts and then have some guide wires going horizontally for the arms of the grape. And that's a great way to get started. So, but I didn't know, did you realize that 25,000 farms grow grapes?
I had no idea. For profit?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
No, I had no idea.
So, and we do export grapes mm-hmm. to other countries, which usually—
Fox grapes, muscadines?
Yes, all of that stuff.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So, there's quite a list available online explaining the different kinds of grapes you can grow, and that's really going to determine what part of the country you're in. And you, the best for the table wine or for table grapes or for wine, sometimes you do need two different kinds for pollination, but that's always going to depend on the kinds that you want to use or that's best for your area. First, grapevines can be purchased either by bare root or my favorite, someone established plants, so I can see that they're alive.
Yeah, by bare root, you mean you actually would mail order them and the roots would be naked, so
yes,
to speak?
Yes, yes. And so you would hopefully get those in very early spring and you're going to plant those. You need to make sure that they're at least 1 year or 2 years old. And that's buying your grape, your bare roots, or even your containerized grapevines from a reliable source. And it's very important for reasons that you've described that they're virus-free, you know, because mm-hmm. sometimes they do get some viruses that will arise depending on where you are in the country. Mm-hmm. Now, you will need a sunny location, you know, about 4 to 6 hours. Great if you could protect it from the heat of the day, you know, again, depending where you live. Here in the South, we always have to protect a lot of our plants from the heat of the day, which is in the afternoon. And that way your vines won't get stressed out. Your fruit won't shrivel, you know, in the heat of 100 degrees.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Now, of course, like everything else, you need well-drained soil and you'll need to amend it with plenty of organic matter. pH isn't that much of an issue. It could be slightly acidic to neutral, you know.
But grape is one of those plants that really does not do well in clay or in sand. I mean, more so than other fruits that I know. It likes good soil?
Well, you know, clay is an issue here in the South, and we always try to amend that to help with the aeration. But the muscadine do really well with that. As always, you need to incorporate a good bit of organic matter, you know, just to, especially in urban areas, to promote the health of the soil. Now, in most regions, pH wouldn't be that much of an issue because it does have a nice range of about 5.5 to 7. Now, if you're in more of the alkaline areas of the country, you'll need to, you know, reduce that. And like I said, planting those either bare root or containerized plants in that environment I just described, you'll want to put it close to your trellis system. And I've described that as like, you know, 6 to 10 foot high posts even, and you'll plant it in between those posts. And I recommend trying a couple of them if you have the space. You know, in my yard, I could only use one. But, you know, if you can do a couple, that would be great. And make sure you have that horizontal guide wires so you can help with the arms. Now, I would soak your bare roots for about 2 to 3 hours before you, any bare root plant, honestly, for about 2 to 3 hours in water. Yes.
Before. When you're doing a bare root, and I'm with you at 2 to 3 hours, okay. But it's also important to be careful not to actually let the plant sit in that for a day or two, because what happens is that you run out of oxygen, and plants actually do need a little bit of air around the roots, just a little bit, and the water can grow stagnant over time.
Right. That's a good point. And sometimes I kind of allow really an hour, you know, at least an hour just to help get it. You're kind of waking it up, you know, somewhat by doing that and then installing it in the ground and, you know, covering it up, which is very important that you don't cover the crown. Every bare-rooted plant has some kind of crown, and that's visible where that transition zone from root to stem, you know, occurs. Now, of course, you're going to water it well, and you're going to plant it close to your trellis system, and that's so you can easily train that first year's shoot. So planting it isn't anything different than you would plant anything else. But it's just you want to get it close enough to your trellis system because a shoot is going to elongate out of your plant, and you're going to train that to be the main trunk. That is key because that's going to support your heavy grape load going to occur.
You probably will have a heavy grape load.
Absolutely.
Grapes are heavy producing plants.
Now, one thing I'd like to mention, not to be a joy killer, but you are probably—
Such a buzzkill.
I know, I'm such a buzzkill. You're not going to get, you shouldn't allow anyway, fruit production until year three.
Okay.
And hopefully in year one and two, you have established that great framework to help carry the load of following years. So I'd like to go over for year one and two in terms of pruning and establishing your plant, because that is the real key here. You know, we all need to water our plants. We know that, but the training part is really important. So the first year, your main goal is to establish a main trunk. Like I said, to build a strong structure for your vine to hold fruit. The first year, you're going to choose the most straight, vigorous shoot to tie on your trellis, and many shoots will emerge from your new plant, but choose the most vigorous one. Now, I will warn you, you might break a few as you're trying to do this. I would do that.
So now, one thing about plants, don't be shy.
Don't be shy. So I kind of choose that one main shoot before I start removing the others, because you will eventually remove those others. So once you've successfully tied that on, remove the others. And then as continue to guide that main trunk as it elongates, hopefully, up that 6 to 10 feet. Now, it may not grow 6 to 10 feet that first year, but you're going to continue tying it, you know, as it grows. You know, with tape, with garden tape is fine. And then anything, you're going to let it, if it starts to grow lateral branches, you won't be forced to remove anything like that until it gets up to the 6 feet mark. But I'm jumping ahead here to year two. So here we are, end of the growing season. Hopefully your main trunk is about 3 feet tall, 4 feet tall, and your spring is coming, and so now some pruning happens, all right? So you're going to remove any branches that are irregular other than the main trunk. So you're forcing that plant to focus all of its energy still on this main trunk.
Right.
And by the end of the second year, hopefully it's reached that, you know, about 6 feet tall mark, if that's how tall you did your posts. And if it starts to grow above that, you're going to start cutting the top of the terminal growth there. So now you're going to force branching to occur off to the side. And that is the arms of where the fruit will be produced off of further growth that happens. Yes, I can tell you have a question.
Well, it's not a question. It's more of a comment. Now, I haven't done a lot of work with grapes, but I have had people call me crying because...
They're bleeding.
That's exactly right. Yes. How did you know?
Because that is something that happens a good bit because you're pruning around early spring, and that's when sapwood and things like that start to become really active. So yes, so there's a name for that. What's the name for that?
Guttation. I just like the name Guttation.
You just like to say big words.
Yeah, I do. It makes me feel smart.
Guttation. But yes, that is where. Actually, you could see water dripping off the leaves from grapes, leaves.
Let me ask this. Is it a problem?
No, it's not a problem. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast,
right.
so to speak.
So if I cut a grapevine and it has a little trickle of water out of the stem,
no,
it's just not that big a deal.
It's actually telling you it's thriving.
Hey, I like that.
I like signs like that, too. Yeah. We all need a little help to
right.
figure out what we're doing. Now, so back to hopefully by around mid to the end of your second year, you've reached the top of your trellis system. You're cutting off the top of that terminal growth to force that lateral growth, okay? You're done. You're done for the year. You're going to remove any flowers or any kind of fruit production.
Anything that could become a fruit
is
gone.
It's going to be painful, but you know it's not going to really produce anything you're going to be proud of anyway.
Right.
So, and plus you're putting all that energy back into the grapevine itself. Now here's where the fun comes. So here we come at the spring of the third year. And that is where let's set up a visual where you have your tall grapevine, let's say again, 6 feet, and you have some arm growth. And hopefully in year two summer, you saw some cane growth growing off of spurs, off of the arms of your grapes. You're going to cut those back to the arm growth. Can you believe that we get beautiful grapes on one-year-old growth?
I knew the grape was fast growing, but I actually didn't realize that it was all on single year.
Yeah, so all of those structure you see on grape yards or grape mm-hmm.
That's 1 year.
The framework is years, okay?
Right.
And I've just tried to help you get to a year where they can produce grapes.
Right.
But as years go by, your trunk is going to thicken. The arms are going to thicken and elongate. But literally every spring, you are pruning off that year-old cane growth that produces these grapes.
You know, I just realized something. When they say something like old vine Zinfandel, they're not actually talking about the vines having been there.
Yeah.
I mean, the root system and the main stem mm-hmm. has been there mm-hmm. for a long time. That's the old vine, but the vines that are actually producing the grapes, that's a single year of growth.
Now, so yes, absolutely. And so you're pruning those back every year so you can just produce these great fruits.
That's fantastic.
I know. I love that, too.
The grape... Again, just such an interesting fruit.
It is. I have to say. I mean, we knew it had a lot of history. We know it makes wine. Yeah. Wine. But you know, you didn't mention something that I'm kind of glad you didn't mention because I have a little bit of history.
Oh, please. Go
I know
ahead.
A little bit of history about grapes. So have you ever heard of the grapevine at Hampton Court?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So back in school, I went on a trip and I visited Hampton Court. And I saw this amazing grapevine that is hundreds of years old, and it has its own greenhouse.
Oh, my goodness.
It is. It's called the Grapevine, and it's at Hampton Court, and it's the largest and oldest known grapevine in the world.
That is amazing.
I know something you don't. But the interesting thing, now I have just a little background, is that it started from a small cutting in Black Hamburg, from the Black Hamburg vine at the Valentine's Park in Essex. I don't know if, you know, I was trying to throw in a little history.
That's awesome.
Like you. But yes, you can see that. It's part of their display, and they sell grapes from it to the public.
Very cool.
Okay. But yes, so you can, it's easy to grow vines in your own backyard. And, you know, if you don't want to go to all that trouble, I used to have a client that had this humongous pergola that they just let their grapevine grow wild on it, and it did produce grapes, but they had an amazing structure.
Right.
You know, so it's all about the structure, to be honest.
I was going to say, it sounds like for grapes, the structure and a good soil.
Yes.
And you're good to go.
And the pruning, and you're good to go. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's fantastic.
I know. I enjoyed this so much.
Well, thank you for listening to The Plants We Eat. We look forward to talking at you next time.